across the dooryard. I had left the door ajar to let in light and air. As I turned toward it, Willie's face appeared in the opening, pale and distraught. "Mrs. Fraser, please, will you come? Papa's ill."
"Has he got it from the Indian?"
Jamie frowned at Lord John, whom we had stripped to his shirt and put to bed. His face was by turns flushed and pale, the symptoms I'd put down earlier to emotional distress. "No, he can't have. The incubation period is 1 to 2 weeks." "Where were you?" I turned to Willie, then shrugged, dismissing the question. They'd been travelling. There was no conceivable way of telling where or when Grey had encountered the virus. Travellers normally slept several to a bed in inns, and the blankets were seldom changed. It would be easy to lie down in one and get up in the morning with the germs of anything from measles to hepatitis.
"You did say there was an epidemic of measles in Cross Creek."
I put a hand on Grey's forehead. Adept as I was at reading fevers by touch, I would have put his near 103, quite high enough.
"Yes," he said hoarsely, and coughed. "Have I got the measles? You must keep Willie away."
"Ian, take Willie outside, will you please?" I wrung out a cloth wetted with elderflower water and wiped Grey's face and neck. There was no rash yet on his face, but when I made him open his mouth, the small whitish coplic spots on the lining were clear enough.
"Yes, you've got the measles," I said.
"How long have you been feeling ill?"
"I felt somewhat light-headed when I retired last night," he said, and coughed again. "I woke with a bad headache sometime in the night, but I thought it only the result of Jamie's so-called whiskey."
He smiled faintly at Jamie.
"Then this morning..."
He sneezed, and I hastily groped for a fresh handkerchief.
"Yes, quite. Well, try to rest a bit. I've put some willow bark to steep. That will help the headache."
I stood up and raised a brow at Jamie, who followed me outside. "We can't let Willie be near him," I said, low-voiced so as not to be overheard. Willie and Ian were by the Penfold, forking hay into the horse's manger. "Or Ian. He's very infectious." Jamie frowned.
"Aye. What you said, though, about incubation."
"Yes. Ian might have been exposed to the dead man. Willie might have been exposed to the same source as Lord John. Either one of them might have it now, but show no sign yet." I turned to look at the two boys, both of them outwardly as healthy as the horses they were feeding.
"I think," I said, hesitating as I formed a vague plan, "that perhaps you'd better camp outside with the boys tonight. You could sleep in the herb shed or camp in the grove. Wait a day or so. If Willie's infected, if he got it from the same source as Lord John, he'll likely be showing signs by then. If not, then he's likely all right. If he is all right, then you and he could go to Anauka to tell Nakognawito about the dead man. That would keep Willie safely out of danger."
"And Ian could stay here to take care of you?"
He frowned, considering, then nodded.
"Aye, I expect that will do."
He turned to glance at Willie. Impassive as he could be when he wanted to, I knew him well enough to detect the flicker of emotion across his face. There was worry in the tilt of his brows. Concern for John Grey, and perhaps for me or Ian. But beyond that was something quite different. Interest tinged with apprehension, I thought, at the prospect of spending several days alone with the boy. "If he hasn't noticed it yet, he isn't going to," I said softly, putting my hand on his arm.
"No," he muttered, turning his back on the boy. "I suppose it's safe enough."
"They do say it's an ill wind that blows nobody good," I said. "You'll be able to talk to him without it seeming odd." I paused.
"There's just the one thing before you go."
He put his hand over mine where it lay on his arm, and smiled down at me.
"Aye, and what's that?"
"Do get that pig out of the pantry, please." Chapter 27 Trout Fishing in America. The journey began inauspiciously. It was raining, for one thing. For another, he disliked leaving Claire, especially in such difficult circumstances. For a third, he was badly worried for John. He hadn't liked the look of the man at all when he took leave of him, barely half-conscious and wheezing like a grampus, his features so blotched with rash as to be unrecognizable. And for a fourth, the 9th Earl of Ellesmere had just punched him in the jaw. He took a firm hold on the youngster's scruff and shook him, hard enough to make his teeth clack painfully together.
"Now then," he said, letting go.
The boy staggered and sat down suddenly as he lost his balance. He glared down at the lad sitting in the mud by the Penfold. They'd been having this argument on and off for the last 24 hours, and he had had enough of it.
"I ken well enough what you said, but what I said is that you're coming with me. I've told you why, and that's all about it."
The boy's face drew down in a ferocious scowl. He wasn't easily cowed, but then Jamie supposed that earls weren't used to folk trying, either.
"I'm not leaving," the boy repeated. "You can't make me."
He got to his feet, jaw clenched, and turned back toward the cabin. Jamie snaked out an arm, grabbed the lad's collar, and hauled him back. Seeing the boy draw back his foot for a kick, he closed his fist and punched the boy neatly in the pit of the stomach. William's eyes bulged, and he doubled over, holding his middle.
"Don't kick," Jamie said mildly. "It's ill-mannered. And as for making you, of course I can."
The Earl's face was bright red, and his mouth was opening and closing like a startled goldfish. His hat had fallen off, and the rain was pasting strands of dark hair to his head.
"It's very loyal of you to want to stay by your stepfather," Jamie went on, wiping the water out of his own face. "But you canna help him, and you may do yourself damage by staying. So you're not."
From the corner of his eye, he caught a glimpse of movement as the oiled hide over the cabin's window moved aside, then fell. Claire, no doubt wondering why they were not already long gone. Jamie took the Earl by an unresisting arm and led him to one of the saddled horses.
"Up," he said,
and had the satisfaction of seeing the boy stick a reluctant foot in the stirrup and swing aboard. Jamie tossed the boy's hat up to him, donned his own, and mounted himself. As a precaution, though, he kept hold of both sets of reins as they set off.
"You, sir," said a breathless, enraged voice behind him, "are a lout."
He was torn between irritation and an urge to laugh, but gave way to neither. He cast a look back over his shoulder to see William also turned, and leaning perilously to the side, half off his saddle.
"Don't try it,"
he advised the boy, who straightened up abruptly and glared at him.
"I wouldn't have liked to tie your feet in your stirrups, but I'll do it, make no mistake."
The boy's eyes narrowed into bright blue triangles, but he evidently took Jamie at his word. His jaw stayed clenched, but his shoulders slumped a little in temporary defeat. They rode in silence for most of the morning, rain drizzling down their necks and weighting the shoulders of their cloaks. Willie might have accepted defeat, but not graciously. He was still sullen when they dismounted to eat, but did at least fetch water without protest and pack up the remains of their meal while Jamie watered the horses. Jamie eyed him covertly, but there was no sign of measles. The Earl's face was frowning, but rashless, and while the tip of his nose was dripping, this appeared to be due solely to the effects of the weather.
"How far is it?"
It was mid-afternoon before William's curiosity overcame his stubbornness. Jamie had long since relinquished the boy's reins to him. There was no danger of the lad's trying to make his way back alone now.
2 days, perhaps."
In such mountainous terrain as lay between the ridge and Ana Uka, they would make little better speed on horseback than on foot. Having horses, though, allowed them to bring a few small conveniences, such as a kettle, extra food, and a pair of carved fishing rods, and a number of small gifts for the Indians,
including a keg of home-brewed whiskey to help cushion the bad news they bore. There was no reason to hurry, and some to delay. Claire had told him firmly not to bring Willie back for at least 6 days. By then, John would no longer be infectious. He would be well on the way to recovery, or dead. Claire had been outwardly confident, assuring Willie that his stepfather would be quite all right, but he'd seen the mist of worry in her eyes. It gave him a feeling of hollowness just below the ribs. It was perhaps as well that he was leaving. He could be of no help, and sickness always left him with a helpless feeling that made him at once afraid and angry.
"These Indians, they are friendly."
He could hear the tone of doubt in Willie's voice.
"Yes."
He felt Willie waiting for him to add, "My lord," and took a small perverse satisfaction in not doing it. He guided his horse's head to the side and slowed his pace, an invitation for Willie to ride up next to him. He smiled at the boy as he did so.
"We've known them more than a year, and have been guests in their long houses. Aye, the people of Anauka are more courteous and hospitable than most folk I've met in England."
"You've lived in England?"
The boy shot him a surprised look, and he cursed his carelessness. But luckily the lad was a great deal more interested in Red Indians than in the personal history of James Fraser, and the question passed with no more than a vague reply. He was glad to see the boy abandon his sullen preoccupation and begin to take some interest in their surroundings. He did his best to encourage it, telling stories of the Indians and pointing out animal sign as they went, and he was glad to see the boy thaw into civility, if nothing more, as they rode. He welcomed the distraction of conversation himself. His mind was a good deal too busy to make silence comfortable. If the worst should happen, if John should die, then what became of Willie? He would doubtless return to England and his grandmother, and Jamie would hear no more of him. John was the only other person, besides Claire, who knew the truth of Willie's paternity without doubt. It was possible that Willie's grandmother, at least, suspected the truth, but she would never, under any circumstances, admit that her grandson might be the bastard of a Jacobite traitor, rather than the legitimate issue of the late Earl. He said a small prayer to St. Bride for the welfare of John Grey, and tried to dismiss the nagging worry from his mind. In spite of his apprehensions, he was beginning to enjoy the trip. The rain had lessened to no more than a light spattering, and the forest was fragrant with the scents of wet, fresh leaves and fecund, dark leaf mould.
"Do you see those scratches down the trunk of that tree?"
He pointed with his chin at a large hickory whose bark hung in shreds, showing a number of long, parallel white slashes, some 6 feet from the ground.
"Yes."
Willie took off his hat and slapped it against his thigh to knock the water off, then leaned forward to look more closely.
"An animal did that?"
"A bear," Jamie said. "Fresh, too. See, the sap's not dried yet in the cuts."
"Is it nearby?"
Willie glanced around, seeming more curious than alarmed.
"Not close," Jamie said, "or the horses would be carrying on. But near enough, aye. Keep an eye out. We'll likely see its dung or its prints."
No. If John died, his tenuous link with William would be broken. He had long since resigned himself to the situation and accepted the necessity without complaint. But he would feel bereft indeed if the measles robbed him not only of his closest friend, but of all connection with his son. It had stopped raining. As they rounded the flank of a mountain and came out above a valley, Willie gave a small exclamation of surprised delight and sat up straight in his saddle. Against a backdrop of rain-dark clouds, a rainbow arced from the slope of a distant mountain, falling in a perfect shimmer of light to the floor of the valley far below.
"Oh, it's glorious," Willie said.
He turned a wide smile on Jamie, their differences forgotten.
"Have you ever seen such a thing before, sir?"
"Never," said Jamie, smiling back.
It occurred to him, with a small shock, that these few days in the wilderness might conceivably be the last he would see or hear of William. He hoped that he wouldn't have to hit the boy again. He always slept lightly in the wood, and the sound woke him at once. He lay quite still for a moment, unsure what it was. Then he heard the small, choked noise and recognized the sound of stifled weeping. He checked his instant urge to turn and lay a hand on the boy in comfort. The lad was making every effort not to be heard. He deserved to keep his pride. He lay still, looking up into the sweep of the vast night sky above, and listening. Not fright. William had shown no fear of sleeping in dark woods, and had there been a large animal nearby, the boy wouldn't be keeping quiet about it. Was the lad unwell? The sounds were little more than thickened breathing caught in the throat. Perhaps the boy was in pain, and too proud to say. It was that fear that decided him to speak. If the measles had caught them up, there was no time to waste. He must carry the boy back to Clare at once. "My lord," he said softly. The sobbing ceased abruptly. He heard the audible sound of a swallow and the rasp of cloth on skin as the lad wiped a sleeve across his face. "Yes," the earl said, with a creditable attempt at coolness, marred only by the thickness in his voice.
"Are you unwell, my lord?"
He could tell already that it wasn't that, but it would do for a pretext.
"Have you maybe taken a touch of the cramp? Sometimes dried apples take a man amiss."
A deep breath came from the far side of the fire, and a snuffle as an attempt was made to clear a running nose unobtrusively. The fire had burned down to nothing more than embers. Still, he could see the dark shape that squirmed into a sitting position, crouched on the far side of the fire.
Yes, I think perhaps I have got something of the sort."
Jamie sat up himself, the plaid falling away from his shoulders.
"It's no great matter," he said soothingly. "I've a potion that will cure all manner of ills of the stomach. Do you rest easy for a moment, my lord? I'll fetch water."
He got to his feet and went away, careful not to look at the boy. By the time he came back from the stream with the kettle filled, Willie had got his nose blown and his face wiped, and was sitting with his knees drawn up, his head resting on them. He couldn't keep himself from touching the boy's head as he passed. Familiarity be damned. The dark hair was soft to his touch, warm and slightly damp with sweat.
"A griping in your guts, is it?"
he said pleasantly, kneeling and putting the kettle to boil.
"Mm-hmm."
Willie's voice was muffled in the blanket over his knees.
"That passes soon enough," he said.
He reached for his sporran and sorted through the proliferation of small items in it, coming up eventually with a small cloth bag that held the dried mixture of leaves and flowers Clare had given him. He didn't know how she'd known it would be needed, but he was long past the point of questioning anything she did in the way of healing, whether of heart or of body. He felt a moment's passionate gratitude to her. He'd seen her look at the boy, and knew how she must feel.
She'd known about the lad, of course, but seeing the flesh and blood proof that her husband had shared another woman's bed wasn't something a wife should be asked to put up with. Little wonder if she was inclined to stick pins in John, him pushing the lad under her nose as he had. "It wullna take more than a moment to brew up," he assured the boy,
rubbing the fragrant mixture between his hands into a wooden cup, as he'd seen Clare do. She had not reproached him. Not with that, at least, he thought, suddenly remembering how she'd acted when she'd found out about Lyra. She'd gone for him like a fiend then. And yet, when later she'd learned about Geneva Dunsany, perhaps it was only that the boy's mother was dead? The realization went through him like a sword thrust. The boy's mother was dead. Not just his real mother, who died the same day he was born, but the woman he'd called mother all his life since. And now his father, or the man he called father, Jamie thought with an unconscious twist of his mouth, was lying sick of an illness that had killed another man before the lad's eyes, no more than days before.
No, it wasn't fright that made the lad greet by himself in the dark. It was grief. And Jamie Fraser, who'd lost a mother in childhood himself, ought to have known that from the beginning. It wasn't stubbornness, nor even loyalty, that had made Willie insist on staying at the Ridge. It was love of John Gray, and fear of his loss. And it was the same love that made the boy weep in the night, desperate with worry for his father. An unaccustomed weed of jealousy sprang up in Jamie's heart, stinging like nettles. He stamped firmly on it. He was fortunate indeed to know that his son enjoyed a loving relationship with his stepfather. There, that was the weed stamped out. The stamping, though, seemed to have left a small bruised spot on his heart. He could feel it when he breathed. The water was beginning to rumble in the kettle. He poured it carefully over the herb mixture, and a sweet fragrance rose up in the steam. Valerian, she'd said, and catmint. The root of a passion flower soaked in honey and finely ground, and the sweet, half-musky smell of lavender coming as an after-scent. "Don't drink it yourself," she'd said, casual in giving it to him. "There's lavender in it." In fact, it didn't trouble him, if he was warned of it. It was only that now and then a whiff of lavender took him unawares and sent a sudden surge of sickness through his wing. Claire had seen the effects on him once too often to be unwary of it. "Here." He leaned forward and handed the cup to the boy, wondering whether forever after the lad too would feel troubled by the scent of lavender, or if he would find in it a memory of comfort. That, he supposed, might well depend on whether John Gray lived or died. The respite had given Willie back his outward composure, but his face was still marked with grief. Jamie smiled at the boy, hiding his own concern. Knowing both John and Claire as he did, he was less fearful than the boy. But the dread was still there, persistent as a thorn in the sole of his foot. "That will ease you," he said, nodding at the cup. "My wife made it. She's a very fine healer."
"Is she?"
The boy took a deep, trembling breath of the steam and touched a cautious tongue to the hot liquid.
"I saw her do things. With the Indian who died."
The accusation there was clear. She'd done things, and the man had died anyway. Neither Claire nor Ian had spoken much of that, nor had he been able to ask her what had happened. She had given him a lifted brow and a brief gold look to say that he shouldn't speak of it before Willie, who had come back with her from the corn crib, white-faced and clammy.
"Aye," he said curiously. "What sort of things?"
What the hell has she done? He wondered. Nothing to cause the man's death, surely. He would have seen that in her at once. Nor did she feel herself at fault or helpless. He had held her in his arms more than once, comforting her as she wept for those she couldn't save. This time she'd been quiet, subdued as had Ian, but not deeply upset. She'd seemed vaguely puzzled.
"She had mud on her face, and she sang to him. I think she was singing a papist song. It was in Latin, and it had something to do with sacraments."
"Indeed." Jamie suppressed his own astonishment at this description. "Aye,
well, perhaps she meant only to give the man a bit of comfort, if she saw she couldn't deceive him. The Indians are much more sensible of the effects of measles, you ken. An infection that will kill one of them wouldn't cause a white man to blink twice. I've had the measles myself, as a wee lad, and took no harm from it at all."
He smiled and stretched, demonstrating his evident health. The tense lines of the boy's face relaxed a little, and he took a cautious sip of the hot tea.
"That's what Mrs. Fraser said. She said Papa would be all right. She gave me her word upon it."
"Then you may depend upon it that he will," Jamie said firmly. "Mrs. Fraser is an honourable woman."
He coughed and hitched the plaid up around his shoulders. It wasn't a cold night, but there was a breeze coming down the hill.
"Is the drink helping a bit?"
Willie looked blank, then looked down at the cup in his hand.
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. It's very good. I feel very much improved. Perhaps it wasn't the dried apples after all.
Perhaps not, Jamie agreed, bending his head to hide a smile.
Still, I think we'll manage better for our supper tomorrow. If luck is with us, we'll have trout.
This attempt at distraction was successful. Willie's head popped up from his cup, an expression of deep interest on his face.
Trout? We can fish?
Have you done much fishing in England? I kinda think that the trout streams would compare with these, but I know there is good fishing to be had in the Lake District. Or so your father tells me.
He held his breath.
What in God's name had made him ask that? He had himself taken a 5-year-old William fishing for char on the lake near Ellesmere when he had served his indenture there. Did he want the boy to remember?
Oh, yes. It's pleasant on the lake, surely, but nothing like this.
Willie waved in the vague direction of the creek. The lines in the boy's face had smoothed themselves, and a small flicker of life had come back into his eyes.
I've never seen such a place. It's not at all like England.
That it is not, Jamie agreed, amused. Will you not miss England, though?
Willie thought about it for a moment, as he slurped the rest of his tea.
I don't think so, he said, with a decided shake of his head. I miss Grandmama sometimes, and my horses, but nothing else. It was all tutors and dancing lessons and Latin and Greek. Yuck!
He wrinkled his nose and Jamie laughed.
You didn't care for the dancing, then?
No. You have to do it with girls.
He shot Jamie a look under his fine dark brows.
Do you care for music, Mr. Fraser?
No,
Jamie said, smiling.
I like the girls fine, though. The girls were going to like this wee laddie just fine, too, he thought,
covertly noting the youngster's breadth of shoulder and long shanks, and the long dark lashes that hid his bonny blue eyes.
Yes. Well, Mrs. Fraser is very pretty,
the Earl said politely. His mouth curled suddenly up on one side.
Though she did look funny, with the mud on her face.
I dare say. Will you have another cup, my lord?
Claire had said the mixture was for calming. It seemed to be working. As they talked desultorily of the Indians and their strange beliefs, William's eyelids began to droop, and he yawned more than once. At last, Jamie reached over and took the empty cup from his unresisting hand.
"The night is cold, my lord," he said. "Will you choose to lie next to me that we may share our coverings?"
The night was chilly, but a long way from cold. He had guessed right, though. Willie seized the excuse with alacrity. He couldn't take a lord in his arms to comfort him, nor could a young earl admit to wanting such comfort. Two men could lie close together without shame, though, for the sake of warmth. Willie fell asleep at once, nestled close against his side. Jamie lay awake for a long time, one arm laid lightly across the sleeping body of his son.
"Now, the wee speckled one. Just on top and hold it with your finger, aye?"
He wrapped the thread tightly around the tiny roll of white wool, just missing Willie's finger, but catching the end of the woodpecker's down feather, so the fluffy barbs rose up pertly, quivering in the light air.
"You see? It looks like a wee bug taking flight."
Willie nodded, intent on the fly. Two tiny yellow tail feathers lay smooth under the down feather, simulating the spread wing casings of a beetle.
"I see. Is it the colour that matters, or the shape?"
"Both, but more the shape, I think."
Jamie smiled at the boy.
"What matters most is how hungry the fish are. Choose your time right, and they'll strike anything, even a bare hook. Choose it wrong, and you might as well be fishing wi' lint from your navel. Dinna tell that to a fly fisherman, though. They'll be taking all the credit and none left to the fish."
Willie didn't laugh. The boy didn't laugh much, but he smiled and took the willow pole with its newly tied fly,
Is it the right time now, do you think, Mr. Fraser?
He shaded his eyes and looked out over the water. They stood in the cool shadow of a grove of black willow, but the sun was still above the horizon, and the water of the stream glittered like metal.
Aye, trout feed at sunset. Do you see the prickles on the water? This pool's weakin'.
The surface of the pool was restless. The water itself lay calm, but dozens of tiny ripples spread and overlapped, rings of light and shadow spreading and breaking in endless profusion.
The rings? Yes. Is that fish?
Not yet. It's the hatching. Midges and gnats hatch from their kisses and burst through the surface to the air. The trout will see them and come to feed.
Without warning, a silver streak shot into the air and fell back with a splash. Willie gasped.
That's a fish, Jamie said unnecessarily.
He quickly threaded his line through the carved guides, tied a fly to his line, and stepped forward.
Watch now.
He drew back his arm and rocked his wrist, back and forth, feeding more line with each circle of his forearm, until with a snap of the wrist he sent the line sailing out in a great lazy loop, the fly floating down like a circling gnat. He felt the boy's eyes on him, and was glad the cast had been good. He let the fly float for a moment, watching. It was hard to see in the sparkling brightness, then began slowly to pull the line in. Quick as thought, the fly went under. The ring of its disappearance hadn't even begun to spread before he had jerked the line hard and felt the answering savage tug in return.
"You've got one! You've got one!"
He could hear Willie dancing on the bank behind him with excitement, but had no attention to spare for anything save the fish. He had no reel, only the twig that held his spare line. He pulled the tip of the rod far back, let it fall forward, and gathered in the loose line with a snatch of the hand. Once more, line in, and then a desperate rush that took out all the line gained, and more. He could see nothing amid the flashing sparks of light, but the tug and pull through his arms was as good as sight. A quiver as live as the trout itself, as though he held the thing in his hands, squirming and wriggling, fighting.
Free!
The line went limp, and he stood for a moment, the vibrations of struggle dying away along the muscles of his arms, breathing in the air he had forgotten to take in the heat of the battle.
He got away! Oh, bad luck, sir!
Willie scampered down the bank, pole in hand, face open in sympathy.
Good luck for the fish.
Still exhilarated from the fight, Jamie grinned and wiped a wet hand over his face.
Will you try, lad?
Too late, he remembered that he must call the boy Lord. But Willie was too eager to have noticed the omission. Face fixed in a scowl of determination, Willie drew back his arm, squinted at the water, and snapped his wrist with a mighty jerk. The rod sailed from his grasp and flew gracefully into the pond. The boy gaped after it, then turned an expression of utter dismay on Jamie, who made no effort at all to keep back his laughter. The young lord looked thoroughly taken aback, and not very pleased. But after a moment, one corner of his wide mouth curved up in wry acknowledgement. He gestured at the rod, floating some 10 feet from the bank.
"Will it not frighten all the fish if I go in after it?"
"It will. Take mine. I'll fetch that one back later."
Willie licked his lips and set his jaw in concentration, taking a firm grip on the new rod, testing it with little whips and jerks. Turning to the pool, he rocked his arm back and forth, then snapped his wrist hard. He froze, the tip of the rod extended in a perfect line with his arm. The loose line wrapped itself around the rod and draped over Willie's head.
"A very pretty cast, my lord," Jamie said, rubbing a knuckle hard over his mouth. "But I think we must put on a new fly first, aye?"
"Oh."
Slowly, Willie relaxed his rigid posture and looked sheepishly at Jamie.
"I didn't think of that."
Slightly chastened by these misadventures, the Earl allowed Jamie to fasten a fresh fly in place, and then to take him by the wrist to demonstrate the proper way of casting. Standing behind the boy, He took Willie's right wrist in his own, marvelling both at the slenderness of the arm and at the knobby wrist bones that gave promise of both size and strength to come. The boy's skin was cool with perspiration, and the feel of his arm, much like the tingle of the trout on the line, live and muscular, vivid to his touch. Then Willie twisted free, and he felt a moment's confusion and a peculiar sense of loss at the breaking of their brief contact.
"That's not right," Willie was saying, turning to look up at him. "You cast with the left hand. I saw you."
"Aye, but I'm cack-handed, my lord. Most men would cast with the right."
"Cack-handed?"
Willie's mouth curved up again. "I find my left hand more convenient to most purposes than is the right, my lord."
"That's what I thought it meant. I'm the same."
Willie looked at once rather pleased and mildly shamefaced at this statement.
My mother said it wasn't proper, that I must learn to use the other as a gentleman ought. But Papa said no, and made them let me write with my left hand. He said it didn't matter so much if I should look awkward with a quill. When it came to fighting with a sword, I should be at an advantage.
Your father is a wise man.
His heart twisted with something between jealousy and gratitude, but gratitude was far the uppermost.
Papa was a soldier.
Willie drew himself up a little, straightening his shoulders with unconscious pride.
He fought in Scotland, in the right... Oh.
He coughed, and his face went a dull red as he caught sight of Jamie's kilt, and realized that he was quite possibly talking to a defeated warrior of that particular fight. He fiddled with the rod, not knowing where to look.
"Aye, I know. That's where I met him first."
Jamie was careful to keep any hint of amusement from his voice. He was tempted to tell the boy the circumstances of that first meeting, but that would be poor repayment to John for his priceless gift, these precious few days with his son.
"He was a very gallant soldier indeed," Jamie agreed, straight-faced. "And right about the hands as well. Have you begun your schooling with a sword, then?"
"Just a little."
Willie was forgetting his embarrassment in enthusiasm for the new topic.
"I've had a little winger since I was 8, and learned feint and parry. Papa says I shall have a proper sword when we reach Virginia, now I am tall enough for the reach of Thiers and Longer."
"Ah, well then, if you've been handling a sword in your left hand, I think you'll have nae great trouble in mastering a rod that way. Here, let us try again, or we'll have no supper."
On the third try, the fly settled sweetly, to float for no more than a second before a small but hungry trout roared to the surface and engulfed it. Willie let out a shriek of excitement and yanked the rod so hard that the astounded trout flew through the air and past his head to land with a splat on the bank beyond.
"I did it! I did it! I caught a fish!"
Willie waved his rod and ran around in little circles, whooping, forgetting the dignity of both age and title.
"Indeed you did."
Jamie picked up the trout, which measured perhaps 6 inches from nose to tail, and clapped the capering Earl on the back in congratulations.
"Well done, lad. It looks as though they're biting well, e'en. Let's have another cast or two, aye?"
The trout were indeed biting well. By the time the sun had sunk below the rim of the distant black mountains, and the silver water faded to dull pewter, they had each a respectable string of fish. They were also both wet to the eyebrows, exhausted, half blind from the glare, and thoroughly happy.
"I have never tasted anything half so delicious," Willie said dreamily. "Never."
He was naked, wrapped in a blanket, his shirt, breeches, and stockings draped on a tree limb to dry. He lay back with a contented sigh and belched slightly. Jamie rearranged his damp plaid on a bush and laid another chunk of wood on the fire. The weather was fine, God be thanked, but it was chilly with the sun down, the night wind rising, and a wet sark on his back. He stood close to the edge of the fire and let the heated air rise up under his shirt. The warmth of it ran up his thighs and touched his chest and belly, comforting as Claire's hands on the chilly flesh between his legs. He stood quietly for a time, watching the boy without seeming to look at him. Putting vanity aside, and judging fairly, he thought William a handsome child. Thinner than he should be, every rib showed, but with a wiry muscularity of limb and well-formed in all his parts. The boy had turned his head, gazing into the fire, and he could look more openly. Sap in the pine wood cracked and popped, flooding Willie's face for a moment with golden light. Jamie stood quite still, feeling his heart beat, watching. It was one of those strange moments that came to him rarely, but never left. A moment that stamped itself on heart and brain, instantly recallable in every detail, for all of his life. There was no telling what made these moments different from any other, though he knew them when they came. He had seen sights more gruesome and more beautiful by far, and been left with no more than a fleeting muddle of their memory. But these, the still moments, as he called them to himself, they came with no warning, to print a random image of the most common things inside his brain, indelible. They were like the photographs that Claire had brought him, save that the moments carried with them more than vision. He had one of his father, smeared and muddy, sitting on the wall of a cow byre, a cold Scottish wind lifting his dark hair. He could call that one up and smell the dry hay and the scent of manure, feel his own fingers chilled by the wind, and his heart warmed by the light in his father's eyes. He had such glimpses of Claire, of his sister, of Ian, small moments clipped out of time and perfectly preserved by some odd alchemy of memory, fixed in his mind like an insect in amber. And now he had another. For so long as he lived, he could recall this moment. He could feel the cold wind on his face and the crackling feel of the hair on his thighs, half singed by the fire. He could smell the rich odour of trout fried in cornmeal and feel the tiny prick of a swallowed bone, hair thin, in his throat. He could hear the dark quiet of the forest behind and the soft rush of the stream nearby. And forever now he would remember the firelight, golden on the sweet, bold face of his son.
"Deo gratias," he murmured,
and realized that he had spoken aloud only when the boy turned toward him, startled.
"What?"
"Nothing."
To cover the moment, he turned away and took down his half-dry plaid from the bush. Even soaking wet, Highland wool would keep in a man's heat and shelter him from cold.
"You should sleep, my lord," he said,
sitting down and arranging the damp folds of plaid around himself.
"It will be a long day tomorrow."
"I'm not sleepy."
As though to prove it, Willie sat up and scrubbed his hands vigorously through his hair, making the thick russet mass stand out like a mane round his head. Jamie felt a stab of alarm. He recognized the gesture only too well as one of his. In fact, he'd been just about to do precisely the same thing, and it was with an effort that he kept his hands still. He swallowed the heart that had risen into his throat and reached for his sporran.
No, surely the lad would never think. A boy of that age paid little heed to anything his elders said or did, let alone thought to look at them closely. Still, it had been the hell of a risk for all of them to take. The look on Claire's face had been enough to tell him just how striking the resemblance was.
He took a deep breath and began to take out the small cloth bundles that contained his fly-tying materials. They had used all his maid flies, and if he meant to fish for their breakfast, a few more should be got ready.
"Can I help?"
Willie didn't wait for permission, but scooted around the fire to sit beside him. Without comment, he pushed the small wooden box of bird's feathers toward the boy and picked a fish hook from the piece of cork that held them. They worked in silence for a time, stopping only to admire a completed silver doctor or broom eye, or for Jamie to lend a word of advice or help in tying. Willie soon tired of the exacting work, though, and laid down his half-done green whisker, asking numerous questions about fishing, hunting, the forest, the Red Indians they were going to see.
"No,"
Jamie said in answer to one such. I've never seen a scalp in the village. They're very kindly folk for the most part. Do one some injury, mind, and they'll not be slow to take revenge for it.
He smiled wryly.
They do remind me a bit of Highlanders in that regard.
Grandmama says the Scots breed...
The casually begun statement choked off abruptly. Jamie looked up to see Willie concentrating fiercely on the half-made fly between his fingers, his face redder than the firelight accounted for.
Like rabbits.
Jamie let both irony and smile show in his voice. Willie flicked a cautious sideways glance in his direction.
Scottish families are sometimes large, aye.
Jamie plucked a wren's down feather from the small box and laid it delicately against the shank of his hook.
We think children a blessing.
The bright colour was fading from Willie's cheeks. He sat up a little straighter.
I see. Have you got a lot of children yourself, Mr. Fraser?
Jamie dropped the down feather.
No, not a great many, he said, eyes fixed on the mottled leaves.
I'm sorry. I didn't think... That is...
Jamie glanced up to see Willie gone red again, one hand crushing the half-tied fly.
Think what?
He said, puzzled.
Willie took a deep breath. Well, the sickness, the measles. I didn't see any children, but I didn't think when I said that. I mean, that maybe you had some, but they...
Och, no.
Jamie smiled at him reassuringly.
My daughter's grown. She'll be living far away in Boston this long while.
Oh.
Willie let out his breath, tremendously relieved.
That's all?
The fallen down feather moved in a breath of wind, betraying its presence in the shadows. Jamie pinched it between thumb and forefinger and lifted it gently from the ground.
No, I've a son, too, he said,
eyes on the hook that had somehow embedded its barb in his thumb. A tiny drop of blood welled up round the shining metal.
A bonny lad, and I love him weel, though he's away from home just now.
Chapter 28 Heated Conversation. By evening, Ian was glassy-eyed and hot to the touch. He sat up on his pallet to greet me, but swayed alarmingly, his eyes unfocused. I didn't have the slightest doubt, but looked in his mouth for confirmation.
Sure enough, the small diagnostic coplex spots showed white against the dark pink mucous membrane.
Though the skin of his neck was still fair and childlike under his hair, it showed a harmless-looking stipple of small pink spots.
Right, I said, resigned. You've got it. You'd best come up to the house so I can take care of you more easily.
I've got the measle. Am I going to die, then?
He asked. He seemed only mildly interested, his attention concentrated on some interior vision.
No, I said matter-of-factly, trusting that I was right. Feeling pretty bad, though, are you?
My head hurts a bit, he said.
I could see that it did. His brows were drawn together, and he squinted at even so dim a light as that provided by my candle. Still, he could walk. And a good thing, too, I thought, as I watched him make his unsteady way down the ladder from the loft. Scrawny and stork-like as he looked, he was a good 8 inches taller than I, and outweighed me by at least 30 pounds. It was no more than 20 yards to the cabin, but Ian was trembling from exertion by the time I got him inside. Lord John sat up as we came in, and made to get out of bed, but I waved him back.
"Stay there," I said, depositing Ian heavily on a stool. "I can manage."
I had been sleeping on the trundle bed. It was already made up with sheets, quilt, and pillow. I peeled Ian out of his breeks and stockings and tucked him up at once. He was flushed and clammy-cheeked, and looked much sicker than he had done in the dimness of his loft. The willow-bark brew I had left steeping was dark and aromatic, ready to drink. I poured it off carefully into a cup, glancing as I did so at Lord John.
"I'd meant this for you," I said, "but if you could stand to wait—"
"By all means give it to the lad," he said, with a dismissive wave.
I can wait easily. Can I not assist you, though?
I thought of suggesting that if he really wanted to be helpful, he could walk to the privy rather than use the chamber pot, which I would have to empty. But I could see that he wasn't yet in any condition to be wandering round outside at night by himself. I didn't want to be explaining to young William that I had allowed his remaining parent, or what he thought was his remaining parent, to be eaten by bears, let alone take pneumonia. So I merely shook my head politely and knelt by the trundle to administer the brew to Ian. He felt well enough to make faces and complain about the taste, which I found reassuring. Still, the headache was obviously very bad. The line between his brows was fixed and sharp, as though it had been carved there with a knife. I sat on the trundle and took his head onto my lap, gently rubbing his temples. Then I put my thumbs just into the sockets of his eyes, pressing firmly upward on the ridge of his brows. He made a low sound of discomfort, but then relaxed, his head heavy on my thigh. "Just breathe," I said. "Don't worry if it's a bit tender at first. It means I've got the right spot."
"It's all right," he murmured,
his words a little slurred. His hand drifted up and closed on my wrist, big and very warm.
"That's the Chinaman's way, no?"
"That's right. He means Yi Tiang Chou, Mr. Willoughby," I explained to Lord John, who was watching the proceedings with a puzzled frown. "It's a way of relieving pain by putting pressure on some points of the body. This one is good for headache. The Chinaman taught me to do it." I felt some reluctance to mention the little Chinese to Lord John, seeing that the last time we had met, on Jamaica, Lord John had had some 400 soldiers and sailors combing the island in pursuit of Mr. Willoughby, then suspected of a particularly atrocious murder. "He didn't do it, you know," I felt compelled to add. Lord John raised one eyebrow at me.
"That's as well," he said dryly, "since we never caught him."
"Oh, I'm glad." I looked down at Ian and moved my thumbs a quarter of an inch outward, pressing again. His face was still tight with pain, but I thought the whiteness at the corners of his mouth was lessening a bit.
I don't suppose you know who did kill Mrs. Alcott?"
Lord John's voice was casual. I glanced up at him, but his face betrayed nothing beyond simple curiosity and a large number of spots.
"I do, yes," I said hesitantly, "but..."
"You do? A murder? Who was it? What happened, Auntie? Oh!"
Ian's eyelids popped open under my fingers, wide with interest, then snapped shut in a grimace of pain as the firelight struck them.
"You be still," I said,
and dug my thumbs into the muscles in front of his ears.
"You're ill."
"Ah,"
he said, but subsided obediently into limpness, the corn-shuck mattress rustling loudly under his thin body.
"All right, Auntie, but who? You cannot be telling wee bits of things like that and expect me to sleep without knowing the rest of it. Can she, then?"
He opened one eye in a slitted appeal toward Lord John, who smiled in reply.
"I bear no further responsibility in the matter," Lord John assured me. "However,"
he spoke more firmly to Ian,
"you might stop to think that perhaps the story incriminates someone your aunt prefers to shield. It would be discourteous to insist upon details in that case."
"Och, no, it's never that,"
Ian assured him, eyes tight closed.
"Uncle Jimmy wouldn't murder anybody, see if he had good reason."
From the corner of my eye, I saw Lord John jerk, slightly startled. Plainly, it had never occurred to him that it could have been Jamie.
"No," I assured him, seeing the fair brows draw together. "It wasn't." "Well, and it wasn't me either," Ian said smugly. "And who else would Auntie be protecting?"
"You flatter yourself, Ian," I said dryly. "But since you insist..." My hesitancy had, in fact, been in the interests of protecting young Ian. No one else could be harmed by the story. The murderer was dead, and for all I knew, Mr. Willoughby, too, perished in the hidden jungles of the Jamaican hills, though I sincerely hoped not. But the story involved someone else as well, the woman I had first known as Gilles Duncan, and known later as Gilles Abernathy, at whose behest Ian had been kidnapped from Scotland, imprisoned on Jamaica, and had suffered things that he had only lately begun to tell us. Still, there seemed no way out of it now. Ian was fractious as a child, insisting on a bedtime story, and Lord John was sitting up in bed like a chipmunk waiting for nuts, eyes bright with interest. And so, with the macabre urge to begin with Once Upon a Time, I leaned back against the wall, and with Ian's head still in my lap, began the story of Rose Hall and its mistress, the witch Gilles Duncan, of the Reverend Archibald Campbell and his strange sister Margaret, of the Edinburgh Fiend and the Fraser Prophecy, and of a night of fire and crocodile's blood, when the slaves of 6 plantations along the Yalas River had risen and slain their masters, roused by the Ougon Ishmael. Of later events in the cave of Abandawi on Haiti, I said nothing. Ian, after all, had been there, and those happenings had nothing to do with the murder of Mina Alcott.
"A crocodile," Ian murmured.
His eyes were closed and his face had grown more relaxed under my fingers, despite the gruesome nature of my story.
"You really saw it, Auntie?"
"I not only saw it, I stepped on it," I assured him. "Or rather, I stepped on it and then I saw it. If I'd seen it first, I'd have bloody run the other way." There was a low laugh from the bed. Lord John scratched at his arm, smiling.
"You must find life here rather dull, Mrs. Fraser, after your adventures in the Indies."
"I could do with a spot of dullness now and then," I said, rather wistfully. Involuntarily, I glanced at the bolted door where I had propped Ian's musket, brought back from the storehouse when I had fetched him. Jamie had taken his own gun, but his pistols lay on the sideboard, loaded and primed as he had left them for me, bullet case and powder horn neatly arranged beside them. It was cosy in the cabin, with the fire flickering gold and red on the rough-barked walls, and the air filled with the warm, lingering scents of squirrel stew and pumpkin bread, spiced with a bitter tang of willow tea. I brushed my fingers over Ian's jaw. No rash yet, but the skin was tight and hot. Very hot still, in spite of the willow bark. Talking about Jamaica had at least distracted me a bit from my worry over Ian. Headache wasn't an unusual symptom for someone with measles. Severe and prolonged headache was. Meningitis and encephalitis were dangerous and all too possible complications of the disease. "How's the head?" I asked.
"A bit better," he said.
He coughed, eyes squinching shut as the spasms jarred his head. He stopped and opened them slightly, dark slits that glowed with fever.
"I'm awfully hot, Auntie."
I slid off the trundle and went to wring out a cloth in cool water. Ian stirred slightly as I wiped his face. His eyes closed once more.
"Mrs. Abernathy gave me amethysts to drink for the headache," he murmured drowsily.
"Amethysts?" I was startled, but kept my voice low and soothing.
"You drank amethysts?"
"Ground up in vinegar," he said, "and pearls in sweet wine, but that was for the bedding," she said.
His face looked red and swollen, and he turned his cheek against the cool pillow, seeking relief.
"She was a great one for the stones, young woman. She burned powdered emeralds in the flame of a black candle, and she rubbed my cot with a diamond to keep it hard," she said.
There was a faint sound from the bed, and I looked up to see Lord John raised up on one elbow, eyes wide.
"And did the amethysts work?"
I wiped Ian's face gently with the cloth.
"The diamond did."
He made a feeble attempt at an adolescent's bawdy laugh, but it faded into a harsh, rasping cough.
"No amethysts here, I'm afraid," I said.
"But there's wine, if you want it." He did, and I helped him to drink it, well diluted with water, then eased him back on the pillow, flushed and heavy-eyed. Lord John had lain down too and lay watching, his thick blonde hair unbound, spread out on the pillow behind him.
"That's what she wanted with the lads, you ken," Ian said.
His eyes were shut tight against the light, but he could clearly see something, if only in the mists of memory. He licked his lips. They were beginning to dry and crack, and his nose was beginning